Monster Man, special episode, My Favorite Monster, with ZXU.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a My Favorite Monster episode, that irregular series of specials where I sit down with game creators to talk about monsters, game design, and whatever comes up. My guest today is ZXU. ZX is a writer, translator, and RPG designer from Port Dickson, Malaysia. His first RPG adventure, Lauren's Song of the Bachelor, was published with Hydra Cooperative in 2019. With artist Sharon Chin, he made Creatures of Near Kingdoms, a guide to imaginary Malaysian animals and plants. With artist Mun Kao, his ongoing project is A Thousand Thousand Islands, a fantasy RPG setting inspired by the myth histories, material cultures, and lived realities of Southeast Asia. Zedek, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on. We're going to talk about the animal monster topic that you've chosen for today's episode, and then at the end, we're going to get on to your upcoming project, Reach of the Roach God. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your background in role-playing games. How did you get started writing RPG settings and scenarios?
So I can actually pinpoint this, the point where I actually thought, okay, this is something that I would like to seriously pursue to an exact thing. And this was a blog post by Patrick Stewart, False Machine. I don't remember how I found his blog, but I found a post where he had written about James Scott's Art of Not Being Governed. And this is an academic sort of ethnographic text about the Zomia region in sort of mainland Southeast Asia. It's a sort of mountainous inland region that borders places like Burma and Thailand, sort of, and Laos, and the sort of mainland Southeast Asian nation states claim the region, but it's been fundamentally ungovernable for various different reasons. So it was an interesting post because it was taking a fairly serious subject and a fairly sort of non-nerdish topic. And Patrick was sort of riffing on ideas as he was reading through the book. So it was a read-through and then pulling and quoting from the book and sort of wool-gathering about how one might use these details in a game or in a fantasy or in a fictional setting. So it was the combination of the topic itself, the book is about Southeast Asian thing. So I related to it in that way. But also just the breadth of imagination really felt inspiring. So yeah, it was that post that got me introduced to what Patrick was doing and to the sort of wider old school sort of RPG scene at large. Yeah, that was when I sat down and said, hey, this is what RPG writing is like. I want to do this.
How long was it before you discovered that is, for the most part, not what RPG writing is like, or at least not what many RPG products are like?
That's true. I mean, so previously, I mean, before I found Patrick's work, I started playing with 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, mm-hmm. With the sort of official sort of material, like Wizards of the Coast material. And also before that, I had sort of, you know, had a fascination with the monster manuals and the sort of planes, like campaign settings like Planescape and Dark Sun. And also a lot of the sort of indie design stuff like Dungeon World and Burning Wheel and all these sort of narrative systems and rule sets. But yeah, mm-hmm. the sort of, you're right in the sense that there's a great deal of creativity in terms of like design, like sort of figuring mm-hmm. out new or novel ways to resolve things or mechanize things or abstract sort of systems like sort of meta currencies and ways to roll dice and like resolution and all that. But the sort of writing or the imagination itself felt insufficient because it was largely trying to make games do what the designers already loved in other media, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where And discovering sort of like Patrick's work and creators like him was to discover that, hey, there are people who are not only referencing this sort of pop cultures that they love, and sort of trying to make games that were sort of facsimiles of those things that they love, but also discovering new things to love. And making art out of those rabbit holes. That felt like something worth, I wanted to do that.
So from there, how did that go to your first RPG adventure, Lorne Song of the Bachelor?
I also have a very strong memory of like where I wrote it. I wrote it in a little sort of Tom Yum restaurant, waiting for my partner. She was doing some Muay Thai training at the gym upstairs from that restaurant. I was sitting there with my laptop and I just, sat down and started writing it, and I wrote the first draft in about 3 days. That idea, I grew up with a story that comes from East Malaysia called Bujang Senang, which is about a sort of enormous crocodile that in the sort of 50s, and from the 50s to the 80s, I mean, the sort of dates are kind of like we started killing people. And there was, the story was that this crocodile was a curse upon the community, because one of the community members had died and was murdered. Basically, the crocodile was a spirit of vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking about that story and thinking about, hey, what if I wanted to write a sort of adventure out of this? And so that became Lorne Song of the Bachelor.
And I think Lorne Song of the Bachelor, as you say, obviously features this, kind of its central figure is this enormous crocodile,
yeah,
who is also a person, who, yeah, is also a landscape.
Yes.
And I think that's a good jumping off point to move into the topic that you chose as your monster for this episode, because it is sort of something that runs through a lot of your work, which is this kind of foregrounding of animals, of animal characters, and of animal, I was going to say monsters, and then I keep having to kind of put, question marks.
Yeah.
Next,
yeah.
The Bachelor is very clearly a monster, but certainly not solely a monster.
Yeah, so, the reason why I chose my favorite monster is an animal is because, yeah, there's a certain kind of slipstream sort of quality about how, at least the context I'm familiar with, and how we relate to the spirit world and the natural world, and also myth and what's real and what's not and what's story, I feel like there's a lot to talk about, because this sort of slipstream's quality is not really reflected in sort of like RPG culture, so to speak, which are, so any monster manual or any bestiary that any game system puts out generally tends to be really taxonomical, especially once you get past the second edition of Dungeons and Dragons, things start being broken down into, is this a beast? Is this an animal? Is this a magical beast? This is an aberration? Is this an outsider? And because of that sort of almost empirical sort of pigeonholing, you sort of lose this quality of, I do feel like because there's this pigeonholing, or there's this hard delineation between an animal and a monster.
No, I was going to say, it's interesting how that taxonomy becomes mechanized, like you said, right? So I feel bad because specifically, I give our game master some headaches with that, because, I'll say, well, is this a beast? Is it a spirit? Isn't it? He'll be well, look, it's ambiguous. And I go, look, if it's a beast, I get +4 damage. I need to know.
It's I understand why that happens, because game systems, rule sets are, especially if you get crunchier, they're sort of they're more moving parts, and there's more surface area. The abstraction of the systems have more surface area to interact with each other. So, yeah, you, like a spell that only affects the undead, you need to know what creature is undead and what's not.
Right. We had, as a previous My Favorite Monster, we were talking about, or actually, it was not a My Favorite Monster, I'm sorry, we were talking about the Ruzalka, which is a kind of a water spirit from Eastern European folklore, which is also maybe the ghost of a drowned woman.
Yeah.
And, Is it undead? Is it an elemental? And in that collection of scenarios that we were talking about, there's one in which, you know, stats are given for this creature. I think it's a Lorelei rather than a Ruzalk. It's all pretty much the same thing. And it's a, you know, and it's a ghost. And there's another one where stats are given and it's a water spirit. Because in D&D, you have to be specific about what that is. But that's not how folklore works.
Yeah, yeah. And there is a kind of sort of modern scientificness when you have a world that's basically defined by these sort of hard lines. And because of that, there you tend not to get that sort of dreamlike or ambiguous quality that, that sort of folklore has. And I would argue that actually contexts like Southeast Asia, we still are those kind of places where, you know, the tiger is not just the tiger. It is possibly your neighbor and possibly a god, an animal that you have to respect.
And that was something that I thought was really interesting. You know, as soon as you suggested this idea, one of the first things that I thought was, you know, it is very curious that if you look at early, if you look at the original Monster Manual, it obviously draws from folklore and fairy tales, right? Mm. It's got sprites and pixies and, you know, whatever, boggarts and bukas and bacons and what have you. Mm. Those are not all in Monster Manual 1, but they're all in there somewhere. But what it doesn't have, you know, but when it treats animals, it treats them in a wholly naturalistic fashion, right? So all the animals are like animals from kind of boys' adventure stories, right? Like weasels ripped my flesh sort of. And so those stories that have sprites and pixies and pukas and whatever in them also have like talking geese and like a friendly bear that like helps you with things, right? But they're not in the game at all. Yeah. And I don't know whether that's the influence of, oh, we want to fight a mountain lion like in a Western, or whether it's that's seen as somehow childish in a way that having a Kilmulis stealing grain from the miller in your game isn't. And I don't know why that is, but it's clearly a decision that's made very early on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, yeah, you're right that it's, I mean, it's an interesting topic to sort of explore, like where, what kind of sort of inclinations or biases went into this probably unconscious decision to basically write the bestiaries in this way. I mean, considering that traditional, like sort of old European bestiaries, for example, I mean, there was no distinction really between a chimera and a rhinoceros, because both those creatures were seen in which one is the animal and which one is the monster.
Well, by the time this episode comes out, listeners will have heard the episode that I'm recording on medieval European bestiaries. And yeah, absolutely. Like animals that were familiar to those writers are absolutely fantasized in those bestiaries. There's whole things about, you know, the weird things that hedgehogs and beavers and swallows do. Like, you look out your window and see that that's not true. But that's not the context in which it occurs. That's not how they experience these things.
Yeah, yeah. And so all that like you say, like the what the weasel is said to do. I mean, I'm reminded of a sort of beliefs that have been recorded in sort of ethnographies about basically sort of bezoars or like pearls that are found when you burn a wild boar's body, things like that. So like sort of the magical properties of mundane animals. And you got a question then, like, when did animals become mundane? And I think that's a loss in a way, because for one, you lose out on telling those kind of folklorish stories. And also you a tiger or a fox is a cool creature.
You already have strong feelings about it.
Yeah. So why is it boring in RPGs? And why is like sort of like an orc or a chimera more interesting than a wild boar or more an eagle for that?
And another thing that this seems to do, I think, is to, you know, one thing that kind of traditionally D&D has, although maybe that's being broken down to some extent now, but is this very clear boundary between a threatening other world and this world.
Yeah.
So like you come back to the town where everything is normal. But if you think about like Lauren's Song of the Bachelor, it's not like that. You know, the the town is still this place where everybody understands that.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to bring up, because the boundary between the monster and the animal that we were talking about also affects the world building of RPGs in general. So the distinction between this plane of reality and this plane of reality, and so the idea that dangerous hinterland and the safe town heightens the exoticness of the hinterland and the mundanity of town. But you know, if you bring them closer together, you know, the town is more colorful, and the otherized sort of dangerous hinterland is less dangerous. And I feel that that's at least in our work in Thousand Islands and the other things that we've done. I mean, it's pretty clear that we like a sort of melding of these spaces.
So that brings me then to the specific animal that you mentioned, which is this. All I have here is your description. And can I say just the name of it. Can I say I hate it? So it says here the roach centipede, and I don't know what that is, but I'm pretty sure I don't like it.
Yes. So I realized that I didn't send you the sort of manga. So it's this is I blame manga for this, because how we work is generally manga makes a lot of the images, and then he sends me a bunch of images, and then I see them, and then I write something from them. The roach centipede sounds exactly like its name. Imagine human centipede, but with roaches.
Well, I guess arguably that's an improvement, but
yeah.
I mean, still not great. So tell me a little bit about the roach centipede and its context in Reach of the Roach God.
So it is the primary antagonist in one of our sort of three adventures that the book will include, three separate adventures, interconnected but separate adventures, and it's the sort of main antagonist, I suppose. This particular roach centipede is the daughter of the sort of titular roach god, and yeah, she has arrived in this particular geography because she is fleeing her father, and so she arrives with all her, basically her brood of roaches.
So what about the roach as an antagonist or a feature appeals? What makes it such a good, whether that's a monster or just an animal for the landscape?
So the reason why we sort of fell into roaches being the uncomfortable sort of topic of the book, Reach of the Roach God, is it's a cave book basically, and as we were doing our research and sort of writing and exploring, I think Mankau just settled on the thing that he hated the most, which is roaches.
that's a good approach, I guess.
So he hates roaches, and I hate roaches. So the fact that we are now on working on this book, we've now had to have constantly Googling. I mean, one of my questions was what do roaches look like? What does roach blood taste like? You know, things like that.
No.
Yeah, so it's obviously a very visceral thing for us. That's why I guess it's a good topic.
You know, I like that idea of basing a monster, basing an antagonist on things that particularly repel you.
Yeah.
It does seem like you've cut a rod for your own back there a little bit.
And I think, thinking about it, I was thinking about it before we started talking, and there's something to be said that, you know, a roach is a fairly quotidian sort of animal. Right, it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's very relatable. Most people hate roaches because they are familiar with them.
Yeah, but our sort of visceral reaction to them is kind of, in my sort of emotional response at least, I see the roach as a monstrous thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that this is something that Mankau does fairly often. There are a lot of animals in Thousand Islands, and it is a quality of his art, which I try to reflect in the text, that so fairly mundane sort of seeming animals and creatures are sort of given this, given full personhood, in the sense of this is a monster and it's also a god, and that it has a full culture with art and sort of trade goods and its relationship to neighbors, things like that. Yeah, so it's a way of, I guess I would use the word bringing personhood to a sort of animal in a way.
This ties back to something that you know, we've mentioned in the past, the idea that, like, there's no way to make being killed by roaches a heroic death. It doesn't matter what the mechanical, like, the mechanics of the thing could be exactly the same. But if you're eaten by wolves, that could be a heroic death.
Right.
But if you're eaten by dogs, that's a pauper's death. You know, even if wolves and dogs have the same stats, even if the situation is exactly the same, there's something about the fact that one of them is wolves and the other one is dogs that makes one of them an undignified death. And being eaten by roaches is a million times worse than being eaten by dogs. Like, well, that's the real bottom of the barrel. You're not going to turn up to Valhalla and they ask you how you went and you go, roaches.
You're right in that there is a sort of hegemony of animalhood. Like, a tiger is cooler than a panda, it's cooler than a rat, you know?
Yeah.
But it... I mean, it's part of the challenge, I guess, to sort of upend that. Yes, you know, like, roaches are definitely disgusting in the thing that we're making. But for one, dying under the earth is pretty ignoble anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think there is a, in the course of writing roaches as fully fledged antagonists, I find myself, I don't want to say ennobling them, but sort of finding the cool in what they are is pretty, it is an interesting creative challenge, I would say. Yeah.
Do you find that it has changed your perspective about roaches? Do you now think differently about the roach after having written all this stuff about it, after having done all this research?
I still hate it because it's a phobia, but you know, having done all this work, it's sort of like, so the roaches that we get at home are sort of this sort of like orange sort of caramel colored shell. They're kind of like the size of your thumb, and they have a very particular shape and a particular sort of sheen that I just find revolting, and I am really afraid. But I also realized that in sort of looking at various things and also working in the garden, because there's so many roaches in Compass, but they don't seem to be the same species. They're generally smaller. They're generally sort of darker in shell. They look more beetle-like, and because of that, it's like I've kind of managed to sort of explore the sort of carapace of where my phobias lie, and sort of figuring out which roaches revolt me and which roaches don't. And that's also kind of informed the work itself, because then you get different factions of roaches. Or different aspects of the roach god that might maybe in opposition to each other, and that sort of exploration has borne sort of creative fruit.
That kind of differing presentation of animals is very, as you say, they look more beetle-like. It's like, oh well, if I can mentally categorize this as a beetle rather than a roach, which are the same thing basically, but nonetheless, it is different somehow, right? Like the birds that feed in the bird feeder in my back garden went up in my estimation when they stopped being pigeons and started being doves.
Yeah,
right?
They're
collared doves, which is a pigeon. I mean, it's a pigeon. But somehow it's a little bit nicer because it's a dove.
Yeah, and I think that's something to be said about. And I mean, Thousand Islands is very much inspired by Southeast Asia. And so we often have to sort of think about how what's different in Southeast Asia versus in other contexts. So like this thing about the hegemony of like how cool, like a pigeon is cooler than a dove. Like some of these hegemonies are culturally specific.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like the sort of veneration of the monkey in Thailand, for example, or you know, like temples dedicated to cobras. In the West, you know, a snake is a byword for ignobility, but in a lot of Eastern cultures, it is divine.
Yeah, it's an insult, right? If you call somebody a snake, it's not a compliment.
Yeah, and so like that sort of difference, depending on where you come from and how you relate to a thing, I think that's very interesting, because it's not like it's a different animal.
I think that was something that, you know, when I ran Lawrence Song of the Bachelor, it was definitely something that I think maybe the kind of idea, right, that the monkeys are snobs, that they know they're better than you.
Yeah.
you know, that they're the heirs of this highly advanced civilization, and they sort of think humans are kind of an inferior knockoff model.
Yeah, it's... I know I have a weakness for depicting monkeys as a sort of basically snobbish imperialist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's my... I mean, that's my pet sort of thing to do. So, yeah.
As you say, you know, what animals are seen as having what social roles, you know, is not... I mean, is shared to some... I think people are aware of that, right? Like, I think people look at... For example, in Europe, snakes are not... And not really considered very important either, because we don't... You know, there's one poisonous snake species in Britain, right?
Mm.
But nonetheless, I think people are kind of roughly aware of, you know, the fact that those things vary. But are there examples of things where you've had to kind of think to yourself, like, how does this translate?
Generally, we basically go with what we want to do anyway.
A sound policy.
Yeah, so it's not like it stops us or, like, sort of gives us pause. But it's just being aware of, like the thing about the monkey, for example, I realized that it's not particularly immediate sort of... It's not immediately grokkable, maybe, in places where monkeys are in present in everyday life. But at least in the context where I'm from, you know, like, the Monkey King and Hanuman, and kind of makes it like, yeah, okay, so the monkey is both the animal in your yard, the macaque in your yard that you're trying to chase away because it's digging through the trash, but also a god. And so, like, there is sort of a breath, at least a breath of a range of how you relate to an animal, which is both a pest and worthy of divinity. And yeah, I guess trying to write those things into the work is part of the work.
So as we draw toward a conclusion, I'd like to ask more directly about Reach of the Roach God. So tell us a little bit about, in a word, what is Reach of the Roach God?
Reach of the Roach God is a collection of three interconnected adventures that sort of lead into a sort of rough skeleton of a campaign that takes place underground, where you being the players or people playing the campaign are pushed to sort of interact with this underground dwelling sort of deity of roaches. Mm-hmm. It's inspired by sort of the sort of massive cave complexes that we find in around Southeast Asia. And yes, it will be our first A Thousand Thousand Islands book.
Right. So I was going to say, this is set within the setting that's previously been in the Thousand Thousand Islands zines.
Yes. I mean, and the setting kind of is porous by nature. So it's, you know, it is also, so the book itself will also be sort of treat the setting in that sort of porous way. So apart from the three adventures, there will be sort of like basically three sort of gazetteers for three different cultures that you might find underground.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think people who, you know, have read A Thousand Thousand Islands aren't going to feel, or you know, are familiar with it, aren't going to feel concerned like, oh, if I don't know all the setting details, I'm not going to be able to play this. It's not really that kind of
No, exactly.
Environment. Yeah. Now this is a very different project in terms of, you know, it, or at least it seems like in terms of its scale and in terms of kind of what it is then the kind of, you know, Thousand Thousand Islands have up to this point been compact and modular. Like, what did you find that being different about creating Reach of the Roach God?
So Reach of the Roach God will be a Kickstarter campaign. And I think we did want to do a book length thing, and sort of picking caves was kind of felt like a broad enough but also small enough for a book. So basically, this is kind of our Underdark book.
You can't see that at home, but Zedek has just made air quote gestures around the word Underdark.
Yeah, and we wanted to do a book length book because we felt that, so really we wanted to use a crowdfunding platform and see how viable it is. And this is probably the only way we'll be able to make a book. Because making the zines are simpler because they're smaller and they take less time. And then we can put it out and people can get it and we can survive long enough to make the next one. But a book is a longer sort of period of time. So a sort of Kickstarter thing will help us survive to finish the book.
One of the things that maybe many people sort of weren't aware of before recent discussions sort of began to bring it to more people's attention is you know, some of the challenges of crowdfunding for people who are kind of outside the small handful.
So I would say
of countries.
I would point out that Kickstarter is not available for projects anywhere in Southeast Asia except for Singapore. So the reason we are able to do this is because Mangkhao does have roots in Singapore. So it is technically the Reach of the Roadshow campaign is run in Singapore. So and other Southeast Asian creators have figured out ways to sort of bypass this by working with sort of Western publishers from the UK or the US.
But that of course has its own challenges.
That's true. And the reason why Mangkhao and I thought it was important to try this out, to sort of figure out how we can utilize the platform, it's important for us to be able to do it ourselves. Obviously, it's not we're not alone. I mean, all the decisions we've made are kind of like based on advice kindly given, shared to us by other people who've done Kickstarters. So that we are, of course, indebted to them. But the idea that... So Mangkhao and I are Centaur Games, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to us that Centaur Games is able to do this.
Right.
So we can do this again and sort of build that sort of... the capacity to run it out from where we are.
Currently, the Kickstarter page is up and you can, you know, click on the link to get notified.
That's correct.
When Reach of the Roach God goes live. Do you have a date for the actual launch?
Yes, so we're going to go live on the 9th of November. It will last for a month.
Okay, so 9th of November, going for a month. Mark your calendars.
Yeah, please help us out. A lot is riding on this. So.
Well, I mean, I think that perhaps, there's no need for me to say this because, it might very well be that the kind of people that listen to this podcast are the kind of people who are aware that this is happening in the first place. But, you know, you never know.
Look,
if you didn't know that Reach of the Roach God is coming out, go click the link and subscribe. So apart from Reach of the Roach God, tell our listeners where they can find more of you and more of your work.
A Thousand Thousand Islands has a website. So it's 1000000islands.com. There is a sort of blog. We have been trying to keep the blog updated. Obviously, it's been hard recently because we're sort of gearing up for this campaign. But we generally post sort of like process notes and previews and like just insights into why we did certain things in ways. And also a lot of research notes. So Mangkhao posts stuff on his Patreon, but also to the website. And he basically shares research images and like sort of references. And I want to plug the website because it not only is where you'll generally get the Thousand Thousand Island zines, but we felt it was important to have that website as a resource. So we've managed to be able to host sort of reference material, sort of nonfiction reference material about Southeast Asians, very, very specific and I would say kind of obscure Southeast Asian topics. For example, there is a book about sort of indigenous Malaysian sort of weaving techniques. So basically ethnographies about these very specific subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are the only place where that's available internationally, those particular books.
All right. My guest today has been ZX Su. November 9th, Kickstarter goes live for Reach of the Roach God. ZX, thank you once again very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Okay, that was My Favorite Monster with ZXU. Thank you very much to ZX for coming on the show, and don't forget to check out the link to the Reach of the Roach God Kickstarter down in the show notes. In our next episode, we'll be resuming our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition, and we're going to be looking at some of the weird elementals. And then at the end of the week, we'll have a special listener request episode, so I hope that you'll join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman.
Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.